Good morning. I'm Chris Fanta. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to Partners Asthma Center's Asthma Grand Rounds and our first program of the new academic season. I'd like to take a minute before we start today's specific program to thank the sponsors who have given generously educational grants that make our program and the teleconferencing and the video streaming possible. And they include AstraZeneca, Critical Therapeutics, Genentech, Novartis, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck, Sanofi, Aventis, Schering, Plough, and Seprico. And I thank you very much for making today's program and this year's programs possible. I'd also like to welcome those who are attending via video conferencing. This year we hope to have 4 video conferencing sites, including 2 at the Mass General, 1 at the North Shore, and 1 at Leahy Clinic. Good morning to you, and I hope that if all goes well, we'll get your input with questions and discussion via the video conferencing system. And I would mention to you that if you'd like CME credit for participation in today's program, just if you would make a list of those attending at the video conferencing sites and send it to me by email. This time, with this program, we begin on our website podcast of Asthma Grand Rounds. So if you want to listen to it again, within just a short while, we'll have today's program and future programs available for downloading from our website, www.asthma.partners.org. I'd also like to highlight some of the upcoming programs. It's a very exciting season at Asthma Grand Rounds, and in particular, please note on your calendars the next program, November 3rd, Dr. Bruce Levy will be discussing lipoxins in severe asthma, and the asterisk simply indicates a 1 hour later starting time. So on November 3rd, Asthma Grand Rounds will start at 9:30, not 8:30 due to a conflict with this room. So this morning, a very exciting program, I think, discussing the long-acting beta agonist in asthma with a roundtable discussion by outstanding asthma experts who have a lot to share with us about this topic. And I'd like to introduce them in just a minute as our panel discussants. But before doing so, let me take a minute to set the stage. And why are we here with an interest in the long-acting beta agonists and questions about their safety? It has to do, I think, or is summarized perhaps, in the black box warning that appeared on the long-acting beta agonist, first with salmeterol, I think, in 2004, and states, as you can read here, that the long-acting beta agonist, such as salmeterol, may increase the risk of asthma death. And they cite as evidence the salmeterol multicenter asthma research trial, or SMART, as the sort of seminal study that has caused these concerns. And so by way of introduction, I'd like to take just 2 minutes to review that study, familiar to many of you, but worth reviewing just so that we all start at the same point. This was a randomized, double-blind, parallel group, placebo-controlled trial. It was initiated in 1996, about 2 years after the introduction of Cerevent into the U.S. market. There were multiple sites. It was done in the United States and multiple investigators, and the recruitment had 2 distinct phases. At first, by television, radio, and newspaper advertising, and then the patients who were recruited would be assigned to an investigator. Subsequently, study investigators were recruited, the number increased, and those investigators would recruit patients from their practices. The design of the study was pretty straightforward. Patients who were not already on a long-acting inhaled beta agonist but taking other medications for their asthma, any medications for their asthma, over the age of 12 and not on a beta blocker and not pregnant, would be eligible for participation in the study. There was 1 visit only, at which time information was collected, medication distributed for the entire, a supply for the entire 28 weeks, and then all follow-up subsequently was done by telephone every 4 weeks. In one group having been randomized to whatever medication they were already taking, plus blinded salmeterol, it was a metered dose inhaler, 2 puffs twice daily, or randomized to usual care plus a placebo, 28-week follow-up. And the primary endpoint was combined respiratory-related deaths or respiratory-related life-threatening events defined as respiratory failure, intubation, mechanical ventilation. And respiratory-related deaths would include pneumonia, pulmonary fibrosis, etc. But two specific endpoints I think of interest to us today are the secondary endpoints that were included. They are asthma-related deaths and the combination of asthma-related deaths and life-threatening events, near-fatal asthma. As you know, 26,000 patients were enrolled of the planned 60,000, and at the time of the interim analysis, and then at that point in 2003, the study was terminated by its sponsors, GlaxoSmithKline. And so these are the data, information about these 26,000 patients. Who were they? They were on an average 39 years old, mostly women, mostly Caucasian, as shown here. And their lung function, on average, peak flow at the start of study, about 84% of normal. And here's that major finding. Asthma-related death in the salmeterol-treated group were statistically significantly greater than in those who had been randomized to placebo at the end of these 28 weeks of follow-up. The same was true for combined asthma-related deaths and life-threatening events. Salmeterol-treated group had more adverse events than the placebo-treated group. Were there racial differences? We've heard about increased risk among African Americans. And in fact, if you look at the combined outcome, asthma-related deaths and near death, in fact, African Americans had a relative risk of this event of 4.9, whereas there really wasn't an increased risk among Caucasians. However, if you look specifically at asthma deaths, both groups had an increased relative risk of asthma-related death. Did the use of inhaled corticosteroids influence this outcome? If one looks at those who were, at the time of randomization, using inhaled corticosteroids, there did not appear to be a significant difference in the number of deaths between the salmeterol and placebo-treated group, whereas if one looked at those who were not using inhaled corticosteroids, there looked to be a big difference between the two groups. However, the subgroup analysis was not the intent of the investigators, and it was said quite clearly that data from this study are not adequate to determine whether concurrent use of inhaled corticosteroids provides protection from the risk of these serious outcomes. Finally, in trying to understand these adverse outcomes, did they have anything to do, as was suggested by the authors of this publication, with the way in which patients were recruited? There seemed to be more deaths in both groups in the phase in which patients were recruited by advertising and may not have had a specific physician involved, as opposed to the subsequent years, phase two, when patients were recruited by investigator. And finally, in highlighting the paradox of these observations, is this Kaplan-Meier plot of the probability of surviving through to the end of the study as opposed to dropping out, withdrawing due to worsened asthmatic symptoms. And you can see that in the salmeterol-treated group, far fewer felt that they needed to end the study due to worsening asthma than in the placebo-treated group. So there were more dropouts from worsening asthma in the placebo-treated group. And so the FDA, about a year ago, had issued a public health advisory that said the following: long-acting beta agonists should not be the first medicine prescribed to treat a patient's asthma. It should be used only in patients who have not adequately responded to low to medium dose inhaled steroids, and patients should be advised to seek medical treatment immediately if their asthma worsens. And that's what we know about salmeterol and asthma-related death. And what we hope to learn today from our panel of experts is insights into understanding these observations. What do we make of them? How do we explain them? How have they affected our practice? Should we be concerned? How should we talk to our patients about these findings? I think there's been a great diversity of opinion, and we're eager to have our experts share with us their opinions, and we're eager to hear from you about yours. And in order to facilitate the discussion, to initiate the discussion, what I would like to propose is we begin with a case example as a specific taking off point for our discussion. And here it comes. This is a 20-year-old woman who comes to your office for a follow-up visit regarding her asthma. She's had asthma since approximately age 5. She's never required hospitalization for her asthma. She has known allergies, as shown here, and has mild seasonal allergic rhinitis. You saw her 2 years ago before she went off to college, and at the time she was doing well on her controller regimen that involved an inhaled corticosteroid and a leukotriene blocker. She had called then in the spring during an asthma exacerbation, possibly triggered by a respiratory tract infection, and you had prescribed a short course of oral corticosteroids, which worked quite well for her. And now she reports that she's been very compliant with her inhaler. She takes a budesonide dry powder inhaler, 2 inhalations once daily, and Montelukast, 1 tablet once daily. And she uses her albuterol inhaler before she goes to sleep, and then typically when she first wakes up for some chest tightness, and perhaps 1 or 2 additional times throughout the day if she has asthmatic symptoms. And then once or twice a week, she uses her albuterol because she has some discomfort in her chest at night that disturbs her sleep. She's not sure what wakes her from her sleep, but when she wakes, she feels uncomfortable, and so she reaches for the albuterol. She actually gave up lacrosse at school because her breathing seemed to interfere with her performance, and she was discouraged by that. And she found that she was overusing her albuterol for relief during those sporting events, and it left her feeling uncomfortable. So on examination today, she appears quite well. Her nares revealed mildly edematous mucosa. There's a clear watery discharge. Her chest is clear. And you perform a peak flow measurement, and it is mildly reduced to 320 liters per minute, or 72% of predicted. Or if you are a purist, you perform spirometry and find a similar evidence for mild airflow obstruction on pulmonary function testing. And that's her story. And I'd very much like to invite our panelists now to come up and help guide us through their thinking about how they would approach a patient like this and how in general they deal with the topic of use of long-acting beta agonists in asthma. Can we have the lights up for this, if you would? And I'd like to welcome our panelists to come in front. And when they are seated, I will introduce them in some order of seating. Great. So we are really lucky. I mean, where can you find such a distinguished group of people to come together? All, I would point out, members of Partners Asthma Center. So from your left, I'd like to introduce Dr. Paul Hanaway, allergist practicing at the Asthma and Allergy Affiliates at North Shore Medical Center group that he has founded. Dr. Aidan Long, clinical director of the Allergy and Clinical Immunology Division at the Massachusetts General Hospital, sits next to him. Elliot Israel at Brigham Women's Hospital, allergist and pulmonologist and head of the Asthma Clinical Research Center here. And Dr. Joshua Boyce, Brigham and Women's and Newton Wellesley, allergist and pediatric pulmonologist. What resources we have. So let's begin the discussion, if we would. Maybe we'll start with Dr. Hanaway. If you'd kindly take up the sword. And what's your thinking about this patient? Are you comfortable thinking about, what's your thinking about managing this patient?
Well, basically, she's got a lowered FEV1. She's waking up 2 or 3 times a week. And I think she needs a long-acting beta agonist, in addition to a leukotriene inhibitor and inhaled steroid.
Any misgivings about adding a long-acting inhaled beta agonist to her regimen?
No.
That's pretty clear. Any other opinions in the group?
Chris, I would second that. She clearly has uncontrolled asthma, daily symptoms, impairment in her activities of daily living, waking at night, needing frequent doses of her beta agonist. She's on an inhaled steroid. She's on a leukotriene modifier. One point I'd make is that underlying all of this discussion is how we manage asthma. If the story as it was presented is correct, then she is not evaluated frequently. The record suggests she was seen 2 years ago, left on therapy, then by dint of a telephone call given oral steroids. And it begs the question, how should we monitor asthma? And any decision we make about medication will require frequent monitoring. So while I don't disagree with Paul at all, I think that is the appropriate therapy to use, and there's good clinical study data to suggest that is the next appropriate step. Whatever step we make, she needs to be monitored frequently.
I've read in editorials, if I'm correct, that others have suggested we have other options than long-acting beta agonists in this setting of moderate to severe persistent asthma. Would you consider, Dr. Israel, adding theophylline rather than a long-acting beta agonist? Would you consider increasing the dose or perhaps potency of the inhaled corticosteroid before adding a long-acting beta agonist? Are there others? Do you have a reticence about the long-acting beta agonist? Would you consider other options?
So let me stir the pot a little bit and take a little bit of a contrarian approach. So in answer to your question about adding theophylline, no, I wouldn't consider adding theophylline at this point. The data don't seem to suggest that there's a lot of additional benefit to doing that, and there was a recent low-dose study from the ALA group that suggested that there's not a lot of benefit to doing that. I think, though, that she's clearly not well-controlled, and the question becomes, why isn't she well-controlled? And I think that one could go ahead and add a salmeterol long-acting beta agonist and achieve better control, but she's only on budesonide 2 puffs a day, if I recall correctly. Compliance with inhaled corticosteroids is usually quite low. When one looks at renewals of inhaled corticosteroid preparations, after the first, I think it's only 70% of people who actually even fill their first prescription, 60 to 70%, and the renewal afterwards is less than half. So I think the first thing to do is to really go through the question of how well she's complying, whether one could improve compliance, and or whether there's something in her environment that's also making her asthma worse. If she's complying, one of the other options, and I will throw it out, is to say that one might consider increasing the inhaled corticosteroid dose. A, if she's not complying, and B, if she is, one would get benefit. And one of the reasons that we tend to say that we don't want to increase the inhaled corticosteroid dose, besides the question of perhaps increased absorption, although I think we're at relatively low levels, is this question of the data suggesting that there may be an asymptote or a ceiling to the dose response effect of inhaled corticosteroids. In that there's an initial very steep increase and then a flattening of the response curve. But the interesting thing is when one looks at individual patients, one doesn't necessarily see that. And when one looks at groups, the data actually reflect the fact that in real life, people are not necessarily complying at any rate that they do in studies. And so when you increase the dose, for the people who are only taking their inhaled corticosteroid every other day or only taking in the morning and not taking at night, increasing the dose actually does still keep them on the very steep part of the dose response curve.
I think I hear you, Elliot and Aidan, that we have other things to think about, other options to focus on besides medical care, but our question is going to come back to. So she's been very compliant with her medications. We've started to follow her very regularly, and we still find ourselves forced to make a decision about adjusting her medications. It could happen. I'm going to ask Dr. Boyce, who I should say takes care of both adults and children with asthma, what if this were a 12-year-old, hypothetically, and it was high school or pre-high school lacrosse that she participated in? Do you have a different view of the use of these medications for children?
Well, if this were a 12-year-old with an FEV1 of 68% predicted, I would say that's a sick kid. because you don't tend to see baseline FEV1s that low in children with even moderate persistent asthma. And if this were a 12-year-old, I would say this person has essentially two indices of poorly controlled asthma. One being that they're having symptoms with regularity despite using what Elliot would consider to be a reasonable dose of inhaled steroids, assuming that she's compliant, and that she's using her short-acting beta agonist with some regularity. And also, the lung function being low would concern me. So if this were a 12-year-old, I would strongly consider introducing salmeterol at this point. Which is interesting because when I started in pediatric pulmonary disease 15 years ago, I would have put her on prednisone. I think most of us would have put her on prednisone and see if we could correct that FEV1. And I think that was largely because at that time, we were very focused on correcting FEV1 as the major outcome variable from a treatment regimen. And I think we'd be still interested in correcting FEV1 if it's that low, but I think we're more focused now on correcting exacerbations.
If I've heard correctly, all of our panel members have suggested that they would be comfortable starting a long-acting beta agonist in her care, assuming that other issues have been addressed thoroughly. Let me suggest to you that she or her mother comes back with a package insert and says, there's a black box warning here that says, you're trying to kill me or my daughter. Do you offer reassurance? What sort of, what do you share with that patient? Shall we start back with you, Dr. Hanway?
I basically take a shortcut. I have asthma, my oldest son has asthma. And I say to the patient, I think that there are some risks when you use salmeterol by itself without inhaled steroid. And both of us take it there. And that usually stops the discussion. You begin as a personal anecdotal response. I mean, I don't net out all the risks of oral steroids to patients. I don't tell these patients they can get aseptic necrosis of the hip. Nor do I bring up the black box unless the patient brings it up.
Good. Now, there's an interesting point, isn't it, that perhaps the explanation for these findings is that some of the patients had adverse outcomes if they were taking salmeterol alone, not in combination with an inhaled steroid. I don't recommend you say long-acting beta agonist alone. I only recommend it in combination with an inhaled steroid. Is that a consensus among the panel members?
That's a very important point to make. You, in your introduction, perhaps unwittingly said, and that's what we know about salmeterol. In fact, what you were referring to was the SMART study. The SMART study did not allow us to answer that question. But there is an overwhelming preponderance of the literature, most of it prospective randomized controlled trials, of smaller number of patients than the SMART trial, that do not suggest that when these drugs are used in combination, we see an increased rate of exacerbation. So the question, the black box warning is there, it's a real issue. Patients and parents do bring it up. And I think Paul is right. You have to answer it in the context of what we know and what we don't know. And our clinical experience and the large bulk of the literature suggests in combination, this is not a big risk. But I get back to my earlier point, we will monitor you going forward.
Dr. Israel, if you were on the panel, the FDA panel, you weren't, right? No. If you were on the FDA panel charged with designing these black box warnings, would have you suggested that it be omitted from the Advair package, that these are data relative to long-acting beta agonists and aren't applicable to a combination product that includes an inhaled steroid? You can relax if you're taking an inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist together?
I wasn't on the panel, but I probably would not have omitted the black box warning there. If you actually look at the data and the FDA's analysis of the data, the relative risk, even when using corticosteroids, is still about the same when you look at respiratory-related deaths. I can pull up the slide of their analysis, but it's still about 4 to 1. What inhaled corticosteroids do is they decrease the baseline rate of these events. So that if you say that people perhaps who are not on inhaled corticosteroids have a rate of these events of, let's say, 2 per 1,000 and or 3 per 1,000 and one per 1,000, you're increasing to 4 per 1,000 or 3 per 1,000. In the cases of inhaled corticosteroids, the baseline rate is quite a bit lower. It's probably a third to a quarter of that. So you're dealing with an absolute risk that's less. So if you do the calculations, perhaps if you're not on inhaled corticosteroids, and again, you have to realize we're working off numbers where the statistics aren't significant anymore, but if you just use the crude rates, if you say that if you're not on inhaled corticosteroids, your increased risk by being put on salmeterol is perhaps 1 in 1,000. When you're on inhaled corticosteroids, your risk maybe is 1 in 4,000 or 1 in 5,000. But it still looks like it's there.
An excess risk for being on a long-acting beta agonist, even if you're taking inhaled corticosteroids, is what you're suggesting.
Right.
Josh, do you want to tackle the why? How could that be? Because it would be easy to conceive that patients using a long-acting beta agonist without an inhaled steroid might rely on that beta agonist while the inflammation of their airways worsens, they are using it inappropriately, they get severe airflow obstruction, and they die, having not attended to the eosinophilic bronchitis of asthma. But now we hear from Elliot that it's possible that even on an inhaled steroid, there is some potential risk for being on a long-acting beta agonist. How could that be? Do you believe that? Do you have any explanation?
Well, I certainly believe it could be the case. I think one of the things that I would have discussed if this were a slide presentation is that the beta-2 adrenergic receptor is probably there for an important physiologic reason, which is to regulate basal airway tone.
Would you like to use the slides that you have?
Sure. I'll take 3 minutes.
Good. I should say, I'm sorry I didn't do this in my introduction, that we invited each of the panelists, if they had some key point that they wanted to make, to prepare some slides. If it fit into the discussion, they're welcome to show them. And so at any point, if you felt it helpful to use
sure.
the slides, please.
Yeah. Why don't I take care of that now?
Good.
Yeah. Okay. Can everybody see that? So this is just to review how the beta-2 adrenergic receptor actually works and how its signal is induced and how it's turned off. And the first thing to understand is that beta-2 and adrenergic receptors are these serpentine receptors, members of a very, very large family of proteins in the human. And the function of beta-2 adrenergic receptor is mediated by a group of intracellular molecules called G proteins. And there are several different classes of G proteins. The important thing here is to note that every receptor that causes smooth muscle relaxation, whether it's this one or whether it's the E prostanoid receptors, uses this particular G protein called G alpha S. And the reason this is important is that everything that happens when you give a beta agonist, almost everything that happens, is mediated through this protein, which stimulates adenylate cyclase. And in turn, that results in a rise in intracellular cyclic AMP. And a lot of the old asthma drugs, whether they be theophylline or beta agonists, worked by stimulating cyclic AMP. At least that's what was once thought. And it's certainly true here. Cyclic AMP results in the activation of this kinase called protein kinase A. This is very important because protein kinase A phosphorylates a number of proteins that are involved in regulating smooth muscle contraction through calcium and potassium and protein kinase C. So this gives you your bronchial relaxation, also your vascular relaxation and broncho and vasodilatation. There's also a very old literature on beta agonists as stabilizers of mast cells. And that actually is true, at least in a test tube and at least transiently in vivo. That's because protein kinase A prevents the exocytosis of mast cells and also blocks 5-lipoxygenase and leukotriene synthesis. But that's very, very transient. And it's important to note that mast cells become desensitized to beta-adrenergic stimulation very quickly relative to smooth muscle cells. Smooth muscle cells also become desensitized. We'll talk about that in a moment, but that takes much longer periods of stimulation. Now, one other perhaps clinically relevant point is that the other part of this G protein called the beta-gamma subunit actually leads to phosphorylation of the glucocorticoid receptor. And at least in isolated cells, this potentiates the response to steroids. And this was thought to be perhaps part of the basis for the putative synergy between corticosteroids and long-acting beta agonists. Whether that actually translates into people is not clear. Now, these receptors get turned off physiologically, whether it's your own adrenergic agonist coming from your own adrenal or whether it's exogenous agonists that you administer by inhaler. They get turned off. And the way they get turned off is first by phosphorylation, which prevents this GS subunit from reassociating with the receptor, and secondly, by internalization and sequestration inside the cell. Now, these are pretty quick. These happen within minutes, but they're very reversible. And the turnaround time is just a few minutes after you remove the agonist. The receptors will come back. The event that people have been concerned about is this one, downregulation, which involves degrading the receptor and diminished rates of mRNA transcription. This is thought to occur with prolonged stimulation of the beta receptor. It is controversial whether corticosteroids can counteract this. There's some evidence that corticosteroids do, in fact, stimulate the synthesis of new receptors. But when you look at the big picture, I think it is clear that there are multiple biologic determinants of one's response to beta-adrenergic agonists. Maybe Elliot will talk a little bit more about this. There are polymorphisms in the beta-adrenergic receptor. There are other receptors that the beta-adrenergic receptor can associate with, which modifies their function. There is crosstalk with other receptors, for example, from the muscarinic adrenergic or muscarinic cholinergic system. And every single signaling intermediate that I pointed out in that first slide has polymorphisms. So I think that what it boils down to is there are likely to be individual differences in how one responds. We know there are, but they probably go far beyond simple genotyping of the beta-2 adrenergic receptor. And the problem we have right now is predicting who's at risk. Is there a problem here? And can we predict who should and who shouldn't be on long-acting beta agonists based on this type of information? We're just not there yet.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Josh. And I think this is going to lead us soon to Dr. Israel's discussion of polymorphism in the beta receptor. I'm interested in the challenge that you put forth, Josh. Is there any way to pick out a population at risk? If we are concerned at some low level of some potential increased risk of an adverse reaction if I start you on beta agonists with or without inhaled corticosteroid, is there any testing that I can do either in terms of your beta receptor genotype or in terms of desensitization of your response to quick-acting beta agonists? Any thoughts about how we might, if there is a risk, protect our patients?
I'd love to say that it's the genotype or the polymorphism of the beta-adrenergic receptor and we can identify the risk. But there's a big problem here in that the events are so rare that studying the people in whom the events have occurred is difficult. So in retrospect, it would have been wonderful if the SMART study or the CAT Castle study that had been done in England, which also showed an increased risk of these events, which just missed the statistical significance at that point. The patients had been genotyped, but they weren't. There was no blood collected. And so you remember, you're talking about 13 events in a study of 25,000 people in the group that was at risk. And so you're talking about very, very tiny numbers. And so it is going to take us a long time to be able to identify these people and be able to come to some conclusion as to what might identify the risk. You know, I'd be happy to show you the data for the polymorphisms, but I'd show that with the caveat that I'm not suggesting that the polymorphisms determine who's at risk. I think it's interesting to speculate about that, but I think that that can be the leap to say, oh, if you've got the polymorphism, you're at risk, and if you don't, you don't, is one that I can't make. It's fun to kind of speculate that, and that's what we do in science. But I don't think we have any other real clues other than I think the one thing that you can tell from the data is that, and it's kind of counterintuitive, the people who are probably more severe are the people who are probably at greatest risk, right? And again, it's a matter of the numbers. Those are the people who are more likely to have these incident events, right? And so potentially...
And also the group you're most likely to prescribe these medications for.
Right, and so there's the... You know, remember we kept on... This is the tautology we dealt with when people first suggested the possibility that beta agonists might be bad for you, right? And the response always was, well, but people increase the use of beta agonists when they get sick, so you're seeing more deaths and people are using more beta agonists because they're increasing their use when they get sick.
So here's a question. Is it possible that some people take a long-acting beta agonist that is also, I believe, a partial antagonist, and when they find themselves having an asthma attack and in need of a quick relief bronchodilator, it no longer works, and that is a potential, one potential explanation. Paul, do you have some thoughts on that or comment or slides?
Do you want me to?
Your choice.
Do my show?
Okay.
After you hear this, you'll know why I'm sitting next to the door. Uh-huh.
How do I change here?
Click.
Look like a word. I got it. My experience with Zometerol, like a lot of us, goes back to the early 90s, specifically 1994. This drug was developed in England in the 1980s, many publications. The first publication, I think, was actually in the British Journal of Pharmacology in the mid-80s. And then there were several small studies in September 90. This is Ullman and all from Denmark. Zometerol versus albuterol, no tachyphylaxis. And 11 of these 12 patients were on inhaled steroids. In December 90, in Lancet article by Holgate and all, again from England, 10 patients, Zometerol protected against allergen-induced challenge. And reports were blocked possibly early and late phase and decreased bronchial hyperreactivity. And then the first study was a European respiratory by Dahl and all, 692 patients, 76 centers, Zometerol dual placebo, big time. In 1992, another big study by Palmer, again from Europe, 667 patients, 62 centers, Zometerol better than albuterol. And the first big U.S. study was October 92 by David Perlman from Denver. This was 234 patients in 8 centers, 42 patients on BID Zometerol versus QID albuterol. These were milder asthmatics in the English studies, and only 33% were on inhaled steroids. And in this, in most U.S. studies, you were excluded if you'd been on prednisone for several weeks or months. So the U.S. studies look, I think, one of the faults with them is they don't look at real sick asthmatics, and that's not just with this drug, it's any drug. In March of 93, this is a SNIS, or Servant Nationwide Surveillance Study, or CASEL study. It's very similar to the SMART studies, only it was 16 weeks, 25,000 patients, older patients, 50, they were sicker, 70% were on inhaled steroids, 12 deaths in the somatoprim group, 2 in the albuterol group. And this study was subject to many letters to the editor and basically was deemed not statistically significant. July 94, Lancet, Greening et al. This was the first of many, many studies over the next 12 years or 10 or 12 years showing long-acting beta agonists work better than increasing inhaled steroids. And then we all know in April 94, the USDA approved Cerevet and it became a $750 million product within by 2003. These are my personal experiences. In August of 1994, GSK study looking at Cerevet's efficacy in nocturnal asthma, salmeterol versus placebo. No inhaled steroids were allowed. As a clinical investigator, as many people are in this room, from September 2004 to January 2005, I received numerous IND safety reports sent by GSK, you know, per FDA, and sometimes I was getting 2 to 3 a week. And these are reports from all over the world of patients dying, many of them dying suddenly or unexpectedly or experiencing near-fatal asthma while on this drug. And basically, and several of these patients were in clinical trials in Europe, not in the United States. So I looked back at I got to look at the published literature in this before I get too far into this study. So I went back and basically pulled up every article I could find on salmeterol Cerevet. And these are the storm cloud studies. Interestingly enough, this is a study by Fitzpatrick and all. It was done in Edinburgh, Scotland, 20 patients, active placebo, 2-week study, 10 on active drug. One of the patients in this study died. It was a woman with some low-dose prednisone who died possibly after exposure to an irritant or perfume. This was not reported in this study, but you pick this death up later when you look at a study by Clark and all that was published a couple of years later. So when we go to November 1992, Cockcroft and all, he threw out a warning, possible increase in bronchial hyperreactivity with a long-acting beta agonist. And he basically said, approach these drugs with caution. Another study, Brian Lipwith, this was the first, he basically was one of the first to raise the issue, do long-acting beta agonists downregulate or mask inflammation? Now, this is a Clark study. Basically, he described 3 asthmatics with sudden asphyxic asthma, fatal asthma, and they were 1 to 3 weeks after starting this drug, 17-year-old female, 31-year-old male, 20-year-old male. And then in 1994, a letter by Dr. Finkelstein from the South Shore, New England Journal, described 2 elderly patients who died with salmeterol inhaler in hand. In November 1994, and I kind of did this chronologically, the Associated Press released an article that said there are 20 deaths reported to the FDA with this drug since it was released in April of 94. And then this prompted a meeting with GSK, and the FDA, and a Dear Doctor letter came out with changes in the drug incident because serious adverse reactions, including fatalities, had been reported in the U.S. and worldwide. And then in July 1995, Lancet, Brian Lipwith and his group reported decreased response to albuterol and BID salmeterol. And this article is actually reported by a recent letter to the New England Journal, which just came out on August 24th. By Miles Weinberger, who depicted nicely 2 boys with exercise-induced asthma who had a poor response to albuterol while on salmeterol, who, after being put on theophylline, which is Dr. Weinberger's favorite drug, did quite well with exercise. So I went to medical meetings in January and March of 95, February 95. One was in Western Allergy, and the other was the Academy meeting, and I kept talking to friends. I said, "Hey, see any problems?" And yeah, I have. I quickly collected 16 cases of fatal and near-fatal asthma in a period of 3 months. Most were older patients, more severe asthma, 16 to 83. 60% were females, and they were on salmeterol 1 day to 6 months. Could I publish this? No, it was anecdotal information, and you know, some of it was like, you know, having a beer and say, "Oh yeah, I had a patient that died last month. See you later." Docs are unwilling to document the cases, and especially fatal ones. They're unwilling to provide a lot of data, which it may be understandable. We had several patients in our practice who reported the worst asthma attack ever, and this is what I call the Sunday River case. This is an amazing case, actually. February 95, a 34-year-old female who was in the medical profession, long history of moderate asthma, well-controlled aerobin Cerevent, rescue medicine was Maxi, her auto inhaler. She was at Sunny River skiing. I woke at 4 in the morning, acute bronchospasm. I feel like I'm going to die. Couldn't actuate the Maxi or inhaler because you need 30 liters per minute to do that. Fortunately, she was with a lot of other medical people who were very good at CPR. And the person who did the CPR said that she really had to push. She had a respiratory arrest, but not a cardiac arrest. She's put in the ambulance. The nearest emergency was 25 miles away. Halfway to the emergency room, she was met by paramedics who jumped out of one ambulance into the other, and she was intubated on the side of the road, basically, in the main, in the middle of the night. She got the emergency room. She was stable. She had a PCO2, I think, of 48. She was intubated for 10 hours, and amazing enough, the next day she went back to Sunday River. She was discharged. And she was started on salmeterol several weeks before her arrest. She had been on it briefly in the spring and early summer, stopped, and then restarted, I estimate, about 7 to 8 weeks. And we discontinued her of it. We have an 11-year follow-up with her. She's followed by one of my partners, Dr. Hopper. She's had no more severe attacks on inhaled steroids and PRN albuterol, and basically she's classified as mild persistent asthma with normal PFTs. I published this case in the JICI in October 96. I knew if I submitted it as a near-fatal reaction to salmeterol, I probably would have got slammed on. So I sent it in as a failure to actuate the metered dose inhaler. Basically, the message of the case report was your Maxi or auto inhaler cannot be activated by patients who are near respiratory arrest because they don't have enough inspiratory capacity. The rest of the story. March of 1995, I withdrew from the Suravent study. Asked why by GSK. Answer, your drug may be killing people. Bad answer. This ended my career as a clinical investigator very quickly because the word got out that I did this. All right, and this has been followed by a 10-year debate. The best paper, I think, on the debate, or one of the best, is the New England Journal again in December last year. This is followed up by interesting letters to the editor in March 2006, and we all know the history. The SMART study was halted January 23rd. 2003, November 9th, 2005, the FDA issued an advisory to change the labels, and we know about the black box, which we've discussed here today. So that's my personal experience with salmeterol.
Thank you very much. I would like to open this discussion to members of the audience who I'm sure have both comments and questions. I just would like one follow-up point on my own on this particular presentation, which is, could any of us predict the time course of lack of response to a quick-acting beta-agonist bronchodilator after starting a long-acting beta-agonist bronchodilator? That is to say, is there any time frame after which you would say, this patient is no longer at risk because they clearly seem to respond now, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 months after starting their long-acting beta-agonist to their quick-acting beta-agonist? So do you have a sense in terms of beta-agonist physiology or the like, is there an initial period at risk after which we can say you are likely safe? And the second question is, do we know enough about the differences of salmeterol and formoterol to predict whether there might be a difference from a full agonist versus a partial agonist, long-acting beta-agonist, in terms of this concern about blocking response to quick-acting bronchodilator? I'm glad I don't have to answer these questions. I'm hoping someone will leap forward. Josh, do you want to talk about beta-agonist, receptors?
Just very briefly, I don't think we can say if somebody's safe because I don't know that we understand enough about this phenomenon. I don't know that we understand enough about this phenomenon. I don't know that we know that loss of bronchodilatory effect of short-acting beta agonists is a predictor. It might be, and you can certainly demonstrate that in some individuals. Actually, I think most of the literature suggests that the short-acting beta agonists still bronchodilate, but the duration of action isn't as long if you're repetitively administering beta agonists, short or long. The problem is, though, we don't know if that's a predictor because we don't understand. These are rare events, as Elliot pointed out. Fair. We don't understand what's happening.
Fair. Aidan, please.
Come back to a point that I think is important to tease apart. A lot of Paul's presentation related to salmeterol
not necessarily salmeterol with concurrent inhaled corticosteroids. And Elliot spoke about what the SMART study showed and didn't show. But what the SMART study didn't document was whether the patients going forward were still on inhaled steroids. So while the data out available can be analyzed in the way he said, I still think it does not allow us to answer that question. And the other point I want to make is that the concern about beta agonists has been a long-standing one, going on over 30 years. And three previous sort of peaks of concern related to short-acting beta agonists, and in each case they relate to an increase in asthma mortality. There has not been an overall increase in asthma mortality since the introduction of long-acting beta agonists, so it may not be the same phenomenon. And really the question remains unanswered, but still very important to consider. The concurrent use of inhaled steroids might make a significant difference.
Great. I'd like to open up questions from our audience, both here and by video conferencing. I have a live microphone that will allow all participants to hear your questions or comments if you have any.
Hi, I'm Harold Pickett. I'm interested, whoever on the panel would like to respond to, what is it you're doing in your practices with the moderately persistent patients who have been on, who currently are well controlled on combined inhaled corticosteroids and long-acting beta agonists? Are you opening a conversation with them? Are you doing anything with them? I'll tell you, about a month ago I was thinking about this issue and I did a Google search on some of the terms that would be obvious here. And the first five websites that popped up were malpractice attorneys wanting to know if you think that you might have a relative or someone who had been, who had died as a result of this. And I don't mean to be alarmist or anything like that, but I am interested in knowing what, in the context of that point, what are you folks doing with people who are already well controlled, who may not have been on a trial initially of simple inhaled corticosteroids?
So I'm actually mentioning it to every patient I see. Many of them bring it up, but even if they don't, the patients who come back who are on the combination product, I'd say you may have read that there is a warning related to this drug. There probably is some increased rate of death with the use. We don't know whether concurrent use of inhaled corticosteroids, which is the way you use it, actually protects against that. We think that it might, but I can't say for sure. And I actually throw it a little bit back in the patient's ballpark and say, after having said this, where do you want to go? Would you like to try coming off and using a higher dose of inhaled corticosteroid, or do you want to stay with this? And because that risk-benefit ratio is one that I think for a lot of patients has to be a decision that they kind of think about. And some patients say, I'm terrified, I need to come off. I think that's actually generally the minority. A lot of patients say, I feel so good, I'll stick with this. And then there are the ones who are in between who say, I'd like to try off and see what I'm like. And when I initiate, I actually do this as well.
Dr. Long?
So this is a very important question. It obviously came up when the SMART study was released. And I engaged a discussion with the authorities at Partners Healthcare about what should we do in general to any drug which carries a black box warning. What is our obligation to educate our patients? And there's no official policy on that, as you might not be surprised to hear. Although it's being reviewed. But I did, with the help of Chris, draft a document, two separate documents, one that we circulated to all our physicians at Partners Healthcare, and one aimed at the patient. The idea was that we would engage every patient in this discussion. I can report today that hasn't happened. I am not in the habit of engaging every patient, even though I have the wherewithal to do so, and every so often I go through a phase of doing it. But it's a time issue by and large. You could spend a long time per patient discussing this. But there is a document I can share with you that is patient-friendly.
Can we take a question from the Mass General, Cox 2? I'm sorry I can't identify anyone. There's a small image, but if anyone has a question, please shout it out.
Yeah, Dr. Long, I just wonder, even though the actual incidence of death or near fatal death is very, very low, but the proportion of people who are adversely affected by the combination of Theravent is probably much higher. And what percentage actually is that? I mean, it's not going to be 13, 25,000. That may be 20%, that may be 10%. And in that case, earlier you may be able to do your study and find the correlation who's actually adverse, not even affected by it. The other part of this, like the clinician, the dilemma I face with this, is you put a patient comes in, moderate asthma, you put him on it, and when they come back, they play PFT is no better or even slightly worse. What do? Do you take them off because you think they are worsely affected by this? Or do you actually keep it because they actually identify, but they just ask it's getting worse, they need something more, and you keep it piling more things? What do?
Let me rephrase the question a little bit, Johnson, if I can, to say that maybe the deaths or near deaths are the tip of the iceberg. Maybe there is a broader base of people who are being adversely affected by the use of long-acting beta agonists. Is there evidence to support that? Do we know? Elliot and others perhaps want to take it.
So I actually would say that my thought about that is a little different. It's, I think, pretty clear from multiple sets of studies done all over the world that when you combine long-acting beta agonists and inhaled corticosteroid, you get much better symptom control for the group in general. And that's actually, I think, been one of the difficulties for all of us in terms of these data. Patients really do feel well on these studies. As a matter of fact, when the ACRN did one of its early studies looking at the question of whether salmeterol could be substituted for inhaled corticosteroid, the initial analysis was one that was done based on peak flow as the primary outcome variable. And in terms of peak flow, the group that was on salmeterol actually did as well as the group that was on inhaled corticosteroids. It was only when we looked at exacerbations that we found out that the group that was on salmeterol did markedly worse than the group that was on inhaled corticosteroids. But in terms of patient, and if you also look at patient symptoms, again, the salmeterol group did as well as the group on inhaled corticosteroids. This gets to this question of whether one of the reasons this is happening is that patients aren't perceiving what's happening. And so I think that there's not a large group that doesn't feel well, although to address the specific question, if somebody doesn't improve on the drug, then I'm very quick to take them off. I can't see how, if they're not getting better, why we'd want to keep them on the drug with this question of idiosyncratic reaction.
Nora, do you still have a question that you'd like? I'm going to take a question here from the Bornstein, if we could. At the bottom.
It's on, I guess. That was
sorry.
One question about the exercise component of this patient that we started with, who had significant exercise-related problems to the point where she couldn't actually do lacrosse anymore. And the long-acting beta agonist, there's a loss of bronchoprotection from kind of exercise or some allergen challenge after some period of time. So I'm wondering whether any of the panelists are aware of whether that's a universal phenomenon or whether there's differences in some patients, whether there's a heterogeneity, and whether that heterogeneity could be used as a way to talk about whether patients should be kept on that drug or not.
Can I just repeat the question just in case it wasn't heard by the other sites? And that is the observation that long-acting beta agonist use quickly leads to a tachyphylaxis in terms of bronchoprotection for exercise-induced bronchoconstriction and allergen challenge. Would that in some way, does that vary among people? Would that in some way be a useful way to screen patients at risk for an idiosyncratic reaction to the long-acting beta agonist? Josh, do you want to tackle that one?
I mean, I have no doubt that there's variation. I don't think that that's been looked at in a systematic way, nor do I think that the determinants of that variation are well defined. But as you saw, there are probably, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 genes actually that could play into the speed with which one recovers one's beta 2 receptor function after administration of the long-acting beta agonist.
Great. I think perhaps we have time for one more burning question, if we have one. Otherwise, I think we're going to thank our panelists for a very insightful discussion of a complicated topic and hope to invite you back in a few years where we clarify the cloudy edges of this topic. Thank you very much for participating today.
Which one recovers one's beta 2 receptor function after administration of a long acting beta agonist.
Great. I think perhaps we have time for one more burning question if we have one. Otherwise, I think we're going to thank our panelists for a very insightful discussion of a complicated topic and hope to invite you back in a few years where we clarify the cloudy edges of this topic. Thank you very much for participating today.